Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Every Monday, you and I have the opportunity to meet a man who shares his life story with us. Perhaps you will be inspired. You will certainly find each and every story an interesting one. Today's guest is certainly no different. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Ralph Crowder, who is an independent producer and director for Freedom Radio. Ralph Crowder, welcome to Mind Talk.
Dr. Brewer, it's very nice to be back with you, and this very important independent media platform. Thank you for the invite.
Now, you just heard me describe you as a producer and director. So what does that mean? What do you actually do as a producer and a director? You're rolling in dough, you hire tons of people, and you just play with a camera?
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes producer means that you have to produce something from nothing. And when you're able to do that, I think that's a very special calling, number one. And also, it's a definite need and service to the people, to the community, that needs representation. As you know, media is a very important form of communication, and when we take the initiative to own and control the narrative of the media that is produced, that is something that is a very special calling. So as a producer, you know, I try to study myself, study the community, study the people, and discuss and analyze issues that we all experience. So I think that's important as a producer. Now, the director part is kind of, you know, where you shape those things, you know. We kind of direct energy. So, you know what I mean? Like, just like you're doing today, you're moving energy in this conversation. And that's also a very important calling in terms of media.
Now, you know that there are many people who really see working in the media as a glamorous, easygoing, well-paying, fun-filled path. What do you say?
Yes. Well, I say you must be working for the corporations. you know, hey, you know, we all have a different role to play. You know what I'm saying? For those who choose to give their skills, gifts, and talents to the lowest or highest bidder, I understand that. You know, we all have decisions to make in how we navigate, you know, how we choose to live our certain levels of stability. And then for those of us who choose to be more free and independent and own what we produce, that's a journey. It's a struggle and sacrifice, and I think it's a beautiful struggle. I'm not going to sit here and say that it doesn't hurt at times. But, you know, I would rather own my tongue than sell my tongue away to somebody where the words that I speak are not authentically mine. So,
interesting.
You know, that's where I spent.
Definitely a choice.
Yeah.
As you were growing up as a youngster, what kinds of things were you interested in? How did you actually come to be involved in the media?
You know, there's many different things that I can think of. I'm sure it's connected, first of all, to the influences of my parents and those elders that came before me, and that, you know, mighty thing that they call the gene, the bloodline of the gene, and, you know, the many different experiences of family and your ancestors. So I do believe there's some kind of calling there. Ironically enough, my father was actually retired now in the field of African studies at University of California, Riverside. And one of the books that he wrote was about John Edward Bruce, who was a very pioneering, independent person who was very active and involved in the independent black press, the black media. He was kind of an influence or a role model that Marcus Garvey kind of looked at in terms of the power of the media at that particular time. There was a relationship there. As you know, the history around the black press in this country and also worldwide, for that matter, especially with Marcus Garvey's paper, was very profound and impacted a lot of the discussions and the movements of that time period. And my dad actually penned a book about this particular person who was very instrumental in the beginning of what is now known as the black press. And I don't know where that black press is now, because it seems like we don't necessarily have that as we once did because of that issue of ownership and those choices that we make to potentially sell our products to the corporations. And you know, that relationship we end up losing a lot when we tend to go toward the money. I think there's an exchange that we lose in ownership and connection to the community. So there's a really fine line to navigate that relationship. But anyway.
Well, Ralph, let me interrupt you for a second. And tell us your dad's name. I think I have a hint, since your name is Ralph Crowder III. I'm guessing I know a little bit about his name. But tell us his name and the name of the book that you're talking about.
Oh, yes. My father's same name, Ralph L. Crowder. I'm the third. My dad was the second. And my grandfather's name was, of course, Ralph Crowder. The book was called John Edward Bruce. And the subtitle, I actually have to look about it, but if you Google it, it'll pop straight up or do some research on it. But it was a book penned about John Edward Bruce, one of only two books that was written about him. So I think, as people kind of look into these stories and these great ancestors that we had, we'll find out that we achieved so many things in a time period of so much oppression and so much coming straight out of slavery. We're dealing with people that mothers and fathers were enslaved in this country. And let me correct myself. The name of the book is John Edward Bruce, Politician, Journalist, and Self-Trained Historian of the African Diaspora.
Okay.
And that was penned by Ralph Crowder, and it was published by New York Press.
Okay.
I believe. Yeah.
Great. Thank you for that.
Yep.
The idea that African Americans have had a powerful presence and impact in the media for perhaps years earlier than many folks recognize. What do you think that's all about?
Let me see. Are you asking? Re-ask that question one more time. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm saying that there are African Americans have been a presence in media for longer than perhaps many people are aware of. And I'm wondering what you think that's about. Why is that the case, that we're not as, many of us are not as aware of the true expansive history, and now I'm speaking particularly of blacks in the media, than perhaps other people in the media?
Excellent. Thank you for clarifying that. You know, immediately as you asked the question, I just thought of something to answer that in a way that maybe is understood. It's the reason why we don't have connection, and we're losing connection at a rapid pace. We don't have shared ownership. We don't have ownership. So, if you don't have a sense of ownership in your press or or personally or collectively, then you have no ideas about the shared legacy of that particular accomplishment in that particular topic. So if we're talking about the press or any kind of business, if I wake up every day and I go work for the local grocery store, and I'm just going there to check in and check out and get my check every other week and pay my bills. Well, I don't necessarily concern myself in that particular company's inner workings, you know what I'm saying, or their history and how they were established and how they serve community. My job is to just go simply to clock in, punch out, give my skill and talent, and leave, and really think about how I take care of my family. But if there's shared ownership in that, then of course what comes with that, or a sense of ownership, you know, you do think that, you know, wait a minute, hold on. This is my great uncle who knew my aunt because they went to the same church together. At one point in time, this grocery store started an after-school program that was three blocks down the street from my cousin's house. You know, that kind of level of care and concern. And the way you transfer the important use to communicate history generationally happens when you do have a sense of ownership. Almost like it is, you know, what does it feel like to rent a house opposed to own a house?
It's true.
Do you tend to take care of a house better when you own it? Some would say yes, because you have connection to that land and you feel a sense of ownership. So when it's time to sell the land or pass the land to the next generation, there's a standard that's in place that we expect excellence. We expect a certain communication to your family or to your community or to whoever to keep this ownership serving family or service to the community, whereas when you just rent something, it's just to serve maybe just a daily or a daily need. And I think that's a different level, a different perspective on looking at the history of the black press, if we're going to use that for an example. But I think that's also kind of the shared history that we have just in where we are right now in 2017 in terms of what is black ownership, what does that look like in our community, what does that look like in our family, what are the shared legacies that we hold in high regard to keep our families connected to this great history. And I think the more we lose ownership, the more we lose family and community. So, I mean, I don't know. We're in a very interesting time period.
Speaking of family, one of your more recent projects is a film entitled The Lost Negroes of North America. And even in the title, you know, I'm sure that brings up a lot of stuff for a lot of people. Tell us a little bit about The Lost Negroes of North America. What prompted you to create this, and what prompted you to title it in this way?
Yeah, I think a lot of that stemmed from just kind of like looking inward into myself and where my family is. And the disconnection that exists in my family, just like a lot of other black families, you understand? We are dealing arguably with a total breakdown and disconnect from our family structures that I'm really trying really hard to understand how we're going to how we are going to come back from. I mean, you know, you could use different words like, you know, crises and, you know, disaster and all these other kind of words. But, I mean, I think it's deeper than that. I mean, the breakdown of our family structures and the breakdowns of our communities and the institutions that support our communities, you know, that we shared in ownership with and to, we're losing. We're losing a lot. And I think it's happened so much at a slow pace that the normalization of the impact is something that I don't even think we've even begun to really understand how that's going to play out in maybe my children's children's generation. So this particular film, The Lost Negroes of North America, kind of was like, wow, when you look at it, the African American, whatever that, you know, term means at this point in time, because I would think that as we redefine ourselves and our identity, it seems like, what, every 10 to 12 years or something like that? I would think that that redefinition and that reclassification, or you would think that that represented progress, right? But when I really started to look at things and wanted to go deeper into what I see in the community taking place, arguably, you could say, you know, and this is kind of a question in the whole premise of this particular documentary. You know, you could really say that the Negro was more progressive than the African American.
Okay, and so now that you have said in one sentence something that is sending at least some listeners over the edge.
Okay, yeah, I can clear this now. I mean, I'm ready to go there too. Just let's.
Okay, I tell you what, we're gonna take a break in a couple of minutes, and I don't want to interrupt what you're saying, so we'll just put a pin in that and know that we're gonna come back to that question, which is a profound, for some, annoying for others, frightening for others, insulting for others. I mean, it's just so many things that come up for folks in the question that you raise. But before we go into that in more detail, I just want to quickly ask you, this takes place between 1945 and 1955. And I have to ask you...
A 10-year window.
So I want to ask you to sort of quickly explain why we should care about something that happened in 1945. Who cares?
Who cares? Well, 1945, that was my grandfather. That was a generation of black men and women whose grandparents were enslaved, basically. Many who were enslaved, not all, but many. That was the generation that was a part of the extension and the continued migration from the South to the North and the Lost Negroes of North America. Obviously, we're dealing with the Northern black communities that were self-sufficient, independent, but they really lived in four-season climates, which is something totally different than the South. And so there was an exodus that happened. And there were some experiences that happened in these specific communities that I believe in my research and the way that I'm approaching this piece, that we reached an apex, a point of wholeness, even in the face of the daily oppression that was happening to us as a people. We were so independent, cooperatively supportive of another in our families and our institutions and our businesses and our ownership of land and so forth, that that particular 10-year window, I would arguably say that as a whole, as a group of people, not as individuals, black people moved further at any point in time together in that 10-year period than we have anywhere else in being in this American experience.
Ralph, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will pick up with, was the Negro more progressive than the African American? We'll be right back. Ralph Crowder, a director, a filmmaker, a producer, as we were going to the break and I restated your statement, your question, you laughed. And
yeah, because I...
you know there are folks who are like saying, though, wait a minute, that is not funny. So once again, was the Negro more progressive than the African American? Why'd you laugh?
Well, I mean, because it's kind of meant to shock you, you know.
I'm sure it did.
It's almost an artistic statement, but it's based in facts. You know what I'm saying? Like, let's think about it. When you compare where we are in the African American experience in 2017. Let's take a count right now. How many thriving independent black newspapers do we have in the country right now?
Thriving?
How many thriving independent black radio stations do we have? How many independent black banks do we have? How many of our families or how many individuals? How many of us as a people are in ownership of land or own our own businesses? You know, all these particular kind of lifestyle indicators are critical when you measure some kind of progress. I don't know about you, but what I see is us losing more ownership and giving away more talent and skills to others. And that is coming back to your original question about, why does it appear that, you know, when you're, you know, doing media and that you're a producer or a director, that a lot of people feel that it's a lot of money involved and all this other kind of stuff, which it could be, because the road of sacrifice definitely reaps rewards. But, sacrifice is something, and the reward around sacrifice is something that's earned. And it's not earned like in a 1 year or 2 year or 3 year or 4 year or 5 year window. Sometimes people have to earn that sacrifice for 20 years before you start to see and reap the rewards of the rich rewards that it has. But I know this, though, when you own anything, even if it's the words that come out of your mouth, you are a better service to someone than being bought and sold. And that's just simply said that that generation from 1945 to 1955 was such a force. And I can, let me just read this to you. There, and this was the secretary of, this was a data point that came from the United States government in 1954. And it dealt specifically with the population at that particular time and the level of upward mobility from the whole of everyone, not individual kind of accomplishments or whatever, but this was kind of like where Black people at that particular time as a whole were moving toward in 1954. And I believe, and this is something I'll read it to you. This was the average Negro wage earner today gets four times more money than a few years ago. The Secretary of Commerce of the United States said today his income has increased more rapidly than the income of all other Americans. The Commerce Secretary said he pointed out the family income of the Negroes today at a record high. I mean, think about that. That was in 1954. Tell me any other time in America where that kind of data point could be something that could be anywhere close to that. The income for the group or the whole increased more rapidly than the income of all other Americans?
That's a really stunning statistic.
Oh, yeah, and it's real. Now, think about it. During this time period, this was when the push for integration started happening. Because for those of you who might have lived in that, you know, in that era, which would be my mother's era, my grandparents' era, I'm sure you remember when you had more Black businesses. I'm sure you remember where you could go to Black restaurants. I'm sure you remember when there were independent, where even the Black colleges were even more viable at that particular time. The Black press was a powerhouse. You had things in local communities that were affiliated with the national Black press at that particular time called Associated Negro Credit Unions. These were independent credit unions in different cities that were connected to your local Black news publication. So, for example, in Minneapolis, the historic Black newspaper there was called the Minneapolis Spokesman. And the publisher, the spokesman, along with another members of the community at that time, initiated an Associated Negro Credit Union. But this was also happening in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This was something also happened in Chicago, Illinois. This was something also that happened in other cities. And this, I'm talking about this, right now, my focus in this particular piece is in the northern communities, right? But there was such a thriving community at that time that I really believe that America had to take this great concentration of cooperative wealth, and they had to ask themselves one or two things. Either these Negroes are going to get continue to build on this foundation and surpass many white folks even, or as a whole, we need to get into their economy. We need to integrate their economy into ours, because this could be threatening. This is going to be a problem to our social order of the time. And so many people think potentially integration was like, you know, America's response to their moral authority, you know what I'm saying? Like to be in somewhat a better and better relationship to their fellow human being. I would tend to argue that point. I think that integration was something strictly something different. I think that was strictly around, you know, to integrate the economic power of the Negro economy into the American machine at the time, to potentially hinder and stop that kind of progress.
So you're saying that from your perspective, integration was designed or thought of to hurt Black folks, not to help them?
Yes, strategically. Yeah, okay. Definitely. And when I say that, I'm going from the highest level of how that works. You know, I'm looking at this strictly as an economic decision that America had to make at that particular time period. There's no way that we're going to allow this nation within a nation to have these self-sustained, growing communities, growing populations. Even if you look at different data points around a marriage, Black women married at a higher rate than white women during this 10-year window. I mean, the family structure was totally different. You know, you're dealing with where it's normal, you know, like two-parent households, you know, man in the house, you know, man in the community, woman in the house, woman in the community, children, you know, being raised by two parents. Of course, there were exceptions, like anything, but I'm saying this was something, as we all know, that was a part of the where we come from in that experience of our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents. This was the narrative of the quote unquote Negro, right? So anyway, you had these people that came back from the war. Remember, they were fighting for two wars. Actually, it was double V, I believe, of victory for, you know, the climate and the atmosphere of the defeat in Nazi Germany, but it was also victory with the racism that they felt when they came home, or the racism of America. So there was really strong themes around that from the Black veterans. There were also, again, for those that did not partake in that, you still have to account for this migration from the South to the North, to these communities where, yes, there were racism, and it was overt and covert in many shapes and forms, but the racism of the North took on different kind of hues than the racism of the South. And for whatever it was, these independent communities of the North were able to work from a new sense of possibility, whatever that was at that time period. And the economic movement and the sense of survival around shared responsibility and growing our own institutions at that time period out of necessity for survival generated a great amount of independence. And that independence stemmed from, like I said, the family. It moved into the ownership of land at this time, in this 10-year period also. You see a huge amount of ownership of family homes of that you never seen before. And again, this is from the move from the South to the North. So owning your own land was a theme, and raising your family on that land, and also cultivating institutions to support all that. And so all these things working together, yes. Now, I'm not trying to paint a picture that everybody was doing great, because everybody's not doing great in any kind of time period. But for the whole, for the collective, the Negro of that time period made huge gains that I think that we might take for granted, and we might disconnect ourselves from, because of the negative use and connotation that the word represented in the growing black consciousness that came from those parents. So without the Negro, you would not have the Black Power movement. Without the Negro, you would not have the Pan-African movement. Without the Negro, you would not have the, you know, keep on naming it. These were the people that provided a strong foundation for their children to take the next journey in self-identity and self-determination and so forth. And I think that word got so toxic that we began to disconnect ourselves from the great things that these elders contributed to our growing story in this American experience that we've been dealing with for many, many years.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about what you're saying, and you're certainly providing us with a lot of important history and an important way to characterize or to understand or to experience this history in a way that I would suggest many folks have not. One of the things that comes to mind is our recent election, and one of the candidates suggested to Black America, to African Americans, that it made sense to vote for him because African Americans were living in ghettos, they were in poverty, they were underemployed, it was just, life was really horrifying for Black people, and it was so bad that the suggestion was, you might as well take a chance on me because your lives are miserable excuses for lives.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? And I would suggest some folks bought into that. So I want you to think about that up against what you're describing as, quite frankly, a very progressive period of time in the lives of African Americans. Is there a disconnect? Was this candidate accurate? What are your thoughts about that?
You know, politics is a very, it's mind manipulation, of course, you know, but it's something that we have to deal with. So in many ways, watching and observing statements like that and where we are now, whatever is being said now in context is nothing new. You know, we find ourselves in a space now where I guess, you know, the media likes to point out that a certain individual is a part of the ultra right wing, and he's in the presidential cabinet, and you know, it's all this stuff is nothing new. You know,
Wait a second, Mr. Crowder. Are you suggesting that there have been ultra white right? That was an interesting slip. Right wing individuals in the White House before now? You're kidding.
You know what I'm saying? How do we forget? You know, so again, the manipulation of the media. See, when you don't own something, then the power of your narrative is the one that is able to shape the minds of the people. So I'm amazed that Black folks all of a sudden are so concerned about this quote-unquote right-wing agenda of the new newly elected president and his leadership circle, right? As if that wasn't the case in every other presidential cabinet. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't understand this newfound fascination or surprise that could exist in 2017. So again, whatever is being said, and whatever is being done for that matter, what are we doing? That's really, are we so consumed with CNN and Fox News and MSNBC and the Washington Post or whoever is talking to us? Where is our alternatives? Where are our independent sources of media that navigates whatever terrain we find ourselves in, analyzes the issues with needed critique, but also direct that energy, right, as the director or the producer or what have you, to business, to community, to family. We have many different stories and things that are happening that we need to pay attention to before we even talk about what somebody's doing in the White House.
So
you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Where are we? Because again, in 2017, it seems like we are so consumed by everybody else in a system or in institutions or in machines that we have no vested ownership in. So what are we doing for ourselves? And that goes back to, arguably, again, you can say that the Negro was far more progressive than the African American, because Negroes were writing in black papers. Negroes were paying their own money to buy those papers. Negroes owned businesses that advertised in those papers. Negroes went to their own restaurants or community centers or places of worship or where they convened community conversations to understand whatever the issues are in the community and how we need to respond to that internally and externally. Now, of course, the way I'm looking at that term, many who lived in that period, which is something that also needs to be talked about, we're dealing with a generation of people that have been self-identified four different terms within a 20-year window. So you, at one point in time, depending on where you were, you could have been colored. Then you were Negro. Then you were black, and now, black, and then you were Afro-American for some, and then you became African-American, maybe even, five.
So that's like, a lot of changes to go through within such a short period of time.
Yeah, and so what happens in those evolutions of change or in how one self-identifies or how a people identifies. Sometimes in those transitions of change, we lose the stories and the lessons of the elders who came before us. So if the term Negro at some point in time began to be more of a negative term and a term that represented one's actions that weren't necessarily designed to be responsible to community, then of course, if that term has been kind of placed in that category, then why would we have an interest to reflect back on that? But that's also the power of narrative. And I personally feel that everybody in that particular generation Marcus Garvey identified as a Negro. Elijah Muhammad was in that category. You know, the Negro World was the name of Marcus Garvey's newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of Elijah Muhammad's, he would direct his conversations to, like, what will the Negro do? You know what I'm saying? Like, that was a term. Yes, the evolution of thought, of identity, as we moved on to a higher level of consciousness and connection to Africa. And that was nothing new as a result to the 60s, because people were identifying with Africa, with this particular brother that I was telling you about at the beginning of the show, John Everett Bruce. You know, that's nothing new either. But the thing is that in that 10-year window, something major happened with black folks in America. And it cannot just be dismissed and tucked away in some kind of cabinet somewhere with a whole bunch of dust, and we refuse to reflect on that period of time and the great things, accomplishments and achievements of family, of community, of ownership, and identification of whatever it was at that time. We can't just leave those stories tucked away somewhere and not pull them out for valuable lessons for where we find ourselves now.
The idea, the truth of needing to be mindful and aware of history, not throw it away, as you also are mindful aware of your present and your path towards the future, they're all critical pieces of awareness that perhaps particularly persons of color need to pay attention to.
Look, what would have happened if we still had the Negro Leagues? That strong economic engine that was not only valued in America, but a commodity internationally. People looked at Negro Leagues as a certain level of excellence in that particular sport. But that also encompassed business, ownership, family. Families went. It was a community activity. I mean, there was a lot of things, that people need to learn with that. And what was the value of Jackie Robinson at that time? I get it. I understand. But when you reflect on that, what have we tangibly gained years later in that exchange? Some commercials,
right?
Maybe a couple of people who were acknowledged in an All-Star game and whatever. But we don't even have black folks hardly playing baseball anymore.
It's true. So now that you have really informed our perhaps current way of thinking and reminded us of the reality of yesterday, what do we do today? What do you want folks to do today? What do you want your children to do tomorrow?
Yeah, that's interesting. What do we do today? We have to stand. I think we're losing so much the lost Negroes of North America at this point. African Americans have lost so much to me. This is my personal opinion. That the thing that is going to rescue us in this time of fast-moving realities and themes. Now, you close your eyes. And I say 1945 and the themes that were going on in 1945, the conditions in America and in the world at that time. This is 2017. you don't think if you close your eyes, some of the similar themes are there? Some of the similar dangers of repeating patterns are there? You know, in many ways, when you lose power, you potentially, you know, when you lose power and your commodity, because we have been commodified a lot as a people, and you lose the value of your commodification, the African-American, you know what I'm saying? I'm using that term, African-American, as a commodified term. Okay. Or commodified people. Why am I saying that? Where are we going? Why are we so overrepresented in the public and private prison industry right now? What is really going on in our communities where black men are disappearing due to the various different ways that we are commodified? Maybe starting from the public school system all the way to the prison system. Where are we right now? And how do we get out of being not in a position where whatever we're facing in that daily kind of oppression that has a disastrous impact on our growth in family and community and into our institutions again. The only thing that we're going to have to kind of center us and balance us, as we're very unbalanced now, is to reflect back on history. Because those people from 1945 to 1955, and there's many other stories, you know, after that and before that, but I'm choosing on this piece to focus on that 10-year window. But when we reflect back on those things in our history, that's going to be our power. Those are going to be the tangible examples of what people did to survive. And that's where we are right now. If we don't acknowledge our condition, and if we choose to keep our mouth closed, because many of our mouths are bought and owned because we don't even work for ourselves anymore, if we don't acknowledge our condition, then we're going to repeat the themes of history that we've seen before. And I don't know. Would anybody have thought that Donald Trump would be president 10 years ago? What is this?
And that...
I mean...
that is another conversation altogether.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but
Ralph,
you understand what I'm saying?
I completely understand what you're saying. And I'm pretty certain that our listeners understand what you're saying, and they want to know more about what you are saying and what you are doing. So as we wind up our time today, and it has certainly sped by, can you give folks information about a website or a place where they can go? I don't know whether it's YouTube or a website or you name it, where folks can go to find out more about you and what you're doing.
Okay, thank you. Yes, you can definitely look up our new project, our new documentary film, and we're in the production phase of it now. Heavy in pre-production right now. And we expect this project to really, really actually be an excellent conversation piece, not only for adults, but actually for the young ones, because my expectation is the average 12-year-old or younger that really watches some of the archival footage that we happen to have, they're going to come away and ask themselves, as they look at this imagery from 1945 to 1955, they're going to really ask their parents, or parents, what happened? How come those people look like they're doing so much better than us? And that's been kind of a constant thought that I've had about doing this project and the need to reflect back. So you can actually seek more information on this project and other things that we work on at freedomradioandtv.com. Freedom Radio and, that's A-N-D, TV.com. And I'm fortunate enough to work with a very, very motivated, committed sister named Cindy Lewis, and she will definitely direct you to any answers to any questions that you may have when you navigate our website and give us an email or a phone call.
And is Cindy Lewis available through Freedom Radio and TV.com?
Yes, she is.
Okay, terrific. Ralph Crowder, thank you so much for being here and spending time with us today. I'm going to ask you a question that's been asked of you before, and I'm going to ask you to make it 30 seconds or less, if you would. What would you like people to come away from our conversation today thinking about?
I want people to come away with, these are 2, 3, 4, 5 black people that are committed to being responsible, accountable, to owning our narrative. And it's a struggle, but we choose to make that decision to struggle with and for you. And please continue to support us.
Thank you very much, Ralph Crowder, a documentary filmmaker of many important documentaries. I encourage you to take a look at freedomradioandtv.com, and is spelled out. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work, any research that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you daily at myndtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to hear from you. Send me an email and let me know where in the world you're listening to Mind Talk from. That's Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And remember, you can download the Mind Talk app from iTunes Store, from the Google Play Store. You can subscribe to the Mind Talk podcast via iTunes, or you can go to mindtalk.org every day. There are programs available to you on the homepage and in the archives at mindtalk.org. Again, thank you all very much for joining us today. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then that's exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.